the great Bob Seger and Hollywood Nights, and as the characters in that song, the story of Mickey Rooney has no happy Hollywood ending, and you didn't have to be alive in the 30s or 40s or 50s long ago to know who Mickey Rooney was. That might have been when he peaked and was the best-known star in the world, but even after those years, he continued to work. He was in movies and TV shows and made live appearances right up until he died in 2014. He made tens of millions of dollars, maybe hundreds of millions of dollars, and also blew that and more. And he was victimized, too. In his last few years, people he trusted fleeced him, controlled him, most likely abused him to the point where he was almost a prisoner, according to some reports, afraid of almost everything. We're going to get into some of that with my guest, Bill Burns, who's co-authored this book, The Life and Times of Mickey Rooney. And then a little bit later, we'll open up the phone lines with your questions for my guest. Stay with us. Much more to come here on Coast to Coast AM. You know, Bill, people who are young probably don't remember Mickey Rooney, don't think of him as a great actor or a big star. But in the book, you have some amazing quotes from some of the real, true giants of Hollywood, Spencer Tracy, Laurence Olivier, talking about Mickey Rooney's chops as an actor.
That's right. I mean, he was really well respected by the people he worked with. Spencer Tracy, he was in Boys Town with him, which is a big moneymaker for MGM, very important movie. And Laurence Olivier, they basically thought that he was magic on screen. In fact, one of the great stories of Mickey on screen, this was later in life. Mickey always wanted to be a director, but he never really had the chance to be a director. He was a writer, and he did direct scenes. But in this one particular movie, kind of a B movie, low-budget movie, The Secret Life of Adam and Eve, he noticed that his person he's playing opposite, this actress, she had moved out of her key light. On a movie set, each particular performer is lit, and that's called a key light for that performer. And if you're out of the key light, the camera can't pick you up because you're not lit. So Mickey, while he's crying, and he has to cry on camera, while he's crying, he's moving the actress very gently back into his key light. And the director is like amazed at Mickey's ability to do that, never breaking scene while crying, and the actress never knew she was being moved. I mean, that's how talented this guy was.
I remember seeing Black Stallion. Now, this is after his peak. This is way after his peak. But, man, he was great in that movie.
Not only was he good in that movie, he actually, because we spoke to Carol Ballard, who directed that movie, and he directed that movie for Zoetrope, Francis Ford Coppola's studio. And that film was, Black Stallion was always on the edge of not being made. The weather, I think they shot it in Canada. The weather was terrible. The cast was having a lot of problems. And the young kid who was playing, the kid Mickey was mentoring in that movie, he was having a lot of problems too, getting into character. Mickey, Carol Ballard told us, literally took over the set. That's how talented this guy was. I mean, I met him, obviously, but I am in awe of this guy because he was one of the most consummate Hollywood, he went beyond entertainer. He was one of the most consummate gurus of Hollywood. He took over that set and he coached this kid in Black Stallion through some very difficult scenes, and it was really Mickey Rooney who made that motion picture happen. And the nice part about it was, at the time they were filming Black Stallion, Francis was busy filming Apocalypse Now. So the studio that was distributing this movie really laid off the Carol Ballard as director, Black Stallion, because they were so worried about Apocalypse Now running over budget. And so Mickey Rooney could do what he wanted with the motion picture, and it turns out to be a real phenomenal classic.
Oh, it's a beautiful movie. If people haven't seen it, you should rent it or get it on Netflix or something. You know, in this movie, he plays an ex-jockey who mentors this young kid, and great things happen. He's been a jockey in a lot of movies. Which is, I guess it's a bit of irony because the horses played such a big role in his life.
Right. I mean, he basically lived. Santa Anita was his home away from home. In fact, as a present for the success of the Andy Hardy movies, Louis Mayer put a telephone in Mickey Rooney's dressing room to call his bookie at Santa Anita. But the thing about the jockey was that was one of his first roles. See, he was so short that he could only play a little person, or he could play a jockey because he was only like 5'2". So that was part of the problem with Mickey. But one of the last things he did as playing a jockey role, Rod Serling in the Twilight Zone episode, Last Night of the Jockey, wrote a play for him. And Rod Serling was the modern master of the morality play and the psychodrama. So when you're watching Twilight Zones, what you're really watching is the Renaissance version of a morality play on modern television. That's how wonderful Rod Serling was as a writer. And Serling was also very short. And so he exorcised his demons about being short by writing that particular play for Mickey Rooney. And for one entire episode, there's only one character in that play, in that show, and that's Mickey Rooney going through all the antics. And it's got this O. Henry ending where Mickey winds up wishing that he were tall and he becomes a giant. And that's when the phone call comes from his lawyer saying they want him to be a jockey again.
You know, in the introduction to the book, you have a chunk from an earlier biographer, a guy who'd been assigned or had a deal to write a book about Mickey Rooney, and he details just what a terrible experience it was. The guy was a mess and was barely able to get through it. You said you met Mickey Rooney. Did you face those kinds of challenges that the earlier guy did in writing this book?
He was crazy. This is 2007, 2008. I mean, Mickey was really out of his mind. That's part of the problem is as Mickey got older. He was out of his mind when he was younger because he was out of control. But by the time he was older, by the time he was in his 80s and kind of heading north into his 90s, he really was completely out of control. He had no sense of reality. Reality was whatever Mickey you were going to get when he woke up that morning, whether it was the nice Mickey or the crazy Mickey or the evil Mickey. I mean, that's really what you were dealing with. But poor Roger Kahn. Roger Kahn wrote this very important book about baseball called The Boys of Summer. And in fact, when I was teaching English, I'm teaching a course called Sports and Lit. I actually taught Roger Kahn, so it was great to get this forward from him. But he said that you couldn't talk to Mickey. We would go to the track to meet Mickey, because that's where he lived, at Santa Anita. And he would have this joke that you'd be talking to him, and the trumpeter would play the da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, and Mickey would stand up and salute. That was his national anthem. What Mickey loved to do was go to the stables and talk to the jockeys. And the way he'd bet horses would be the smallest jockeys, that's the horse he would bet, because he figured that was the lightest weight the horse could carry, right? Forget the racing form. And he would try and see where the fix was in for certain horses. And the other problem was Mickey was working for the mob, not when he was in his 80s, but when he was younger, when he was in his 50s and 60s, he was actually doing debt collection for the mob because he owed so much money to the guys in Vegas, because he would go to Vegas, he'd make $50,000 a week at a club in Vegas, say the Flamingo or the Sands. And then he'd lose $100,000 at the crap tables. Well, then he'd skip out without paying his bill. So the guys in Vegas were getting really mad about this, and you don't want to make them too mad. So what they did was they cut a deal with Rooney. They said, look, we will give you collections to make, and you can make those collections for us and work off your debt. So he was really in deep with the mob.
You had mentioned in the book, too, about the making of It's a Mad, 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 Mad World, which one of my favorite movies, hilarious comedy, terrific cast. But I was thinking to myself as I'm reading this book, Man, the last thing you want to do is make a movie where you're doing a lot of shooting in a base of operations in Las Vegas if Mickey is in your cast.
Oh, yeah. I mean, and then you're working with somebody like Jonathan Winters. Jonathan, we're friends with Karen Kramer, who is Stanley Kramer's widow. Stanley Kramer made It's a Mad, 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 Mad World. And so he tells the story that Jonathan Winters, everybody was staying away from Jonathan Winters on the set because Winters had just gotten out of a mental institution. And the person who was most fearful of Jonathan Winters was Milton Berle, because they thought that Winters would go off on him at any minute. And that's what Winters told producer Stanley Kramer. He said, you know, I don't know if you want me in this movie because I can go off in a second. I just came out of a mental institution. And Kramer says to Jonathan Winters, that's exactly what we want. So everybody was wary about staying away from Jonathan Winters and the pickaxe when they were trying to dig that treasure up in It's a Mad, 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 Mad World. But yeah, this was a movie that was really, it was a challenge. That's why Stanley Kramer made it. This is the guy that made the movie Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, Judgment at Nuremberg, The Defiant Ones, High Noon. Stanley Kramer was one of the producers who broke the Hollywood blacklist. And so for him to make a comedy was so far out of his wheelhouse, but he did it on a challenge, Karen told us. And what he did was he had every comic, and these were basically Vegas comics, right? These were people, you know, Buddy Hackett, the consummate Las Vegas comic, Milton Berle, straight out of Burlesque. And the deal was you, each one of you do your own shtick. Ethel Merman, I mean, that was how the movie was done. And it really worked out.
Oh, it's a great movie. Let's talk a little bit about the last couple of years of his life. I read this article last year, before I even knew you were working on the book, in the Hollywood Reporter, and it was about the last days of Mickey Rooney and the picture it painted, this reporter who has to slip money, cash, under the table to members of Mickey Rooney's family just to get the interview. And then during the interview, his wife is kicking Mickey Rooney under the table so hard it leaves a bruise in his leg when he says something inappropriate. The picture being painted is as an old, fearful man who's totally under the control and domination of others around him. His money and his life are not his own. It was very grim, and you make reference to some of that. I just want to get your take on it, how accurate those articles in the Hollywood Reporter were.
Well, Scott Feinberg, who was the reporter who wrote that story, we'd spoken to him, and Scott was actually very graphic. You could find part of that Scott Feinberg interview. I think it was at Vitello's. I'm not sure what restaurant it was. You could find part of that interview online at YouTube. So you could see how fearful Mickey was. Mickey needed Jan's approval. I mean, it was a relationship that lasted 35 years. Jan helped rescue Mickey when he was, he'd had a nervous breakdown. He collapsed on stage. And Jan helped rescue him, and she really revitalized his career, because the two of them would often did this two-person show together. So Jan was a good influence on Mickey. In fact, at some point, there's a great UFO story surrounding Jan Chamberlain, because her father worked for Skunk Works. But so she really helped revitalize Mickey's career, and it was a very stable relationship. But as Mickey got older, on the one hand, he was suffering from dementia. So I know there's a lot of dispute about that, but you talk to his children, you talk to some of the people around him, he really was suffering from dementia. Not severe, but it was. And he was angry. He was just an angry, angry guy. Imagine that when you are 19 years old, 18 and 19 years old, you are earning $20 and $30 million a year for your studio, and you're only getting paid $250 a week because you're a contract player. It gets you crazy. And then you come back from World War II, and you're decorated. Eisenhower, you win the Bronze Star from General Eisenhower, and you're back from World War II, and you can't get a job. You're in your late 20s, and you're too old. And Mickey fought that from, I would say, 1947 on. And the biggest thing he had in his life was this MGM pension, because he'd earned so much money at MGM, hundreds of millions, that he was really entitled to a pension. Well, when this guy Maurice Duke, Sam Stiefel, another famous character, talked Mickey out of his contract at MGM and set up the first independent motion picture company using other people's money, when he did that, Mickey lost his MGM pension. That would have kept him alive throughout his entire life. So here he is, he's in his 80s. Basically, he's just not earning any money. And the money he's earning is going to pay back taxes, going to pay the California Franchise Board, paying the IRS. He's still paying off some of his wives. He just doesn't have any money. And he's really scrabbling. But he is earning money. That's the weird part about this. He's in Sugar Babies, where he's earning something like $80,000, $90,000 a week. And Donald Trump is giving Mickey Rooney investment advice, telling Mickey Rooney, don't invest in this, don't invest in that. Mickey had these crazy ideas for companies, Mickey Rooney Macaroni and Cheese, Mickey Rooney Square Hot Dogs, Mickey Rooney Soft Drinks for Dogs, Mickey Rooney's Disposable Underwear. This took millions. He was putting hundreds of thousands of dollars into these companies that failed. And so he blew through all of his money. He had no concept of marshaling money. The very famous investment banker, Charles Allen, whose daughter, Terry Allen Kramer, was the producer of Sugar Babies, he actually set Mickey up with a stock fund and said, Mickey, don't touch the stock. Don't touch the capital. Live off the interest. When you can't work anymore, this will keep you solvent. Mickey went in, sold all the stock, and Charles Allen threw his hands up and said, there's nothing you can do for this guy. He's his own worst enemy. So that's why Mickey, in his middle 80s, was dead broke. He had all these trust funds, but he couldn't get to them. Dead broke. And his daughters told us, Kelly and Carrie told us, that Mickey complained to them that he had to glue the bottom of his shoes together because they couldn't afford to buy new shoes.
Well, what do you make of the stories? I mean, I can see it. He would have been a handful under any circumstances and would have tried the patience of anyone who's trying to keep him under control, no matter what his age. What do you make of the stories about ripoffs of him dying with almost no money, $18,000 or something to his name, and other members of his family supposedly siphoning off $8 or $9 million?
Well, see, that's part of the mystery. On the one hand, there should exist this trust fund from a couple of the movies Mickey was in of about $500,000 to $700,000, which is yet to be dispersed. So that's one issue that's still lingering. There was a fight, and we spoke to the attorney who was the conservator of the estate. Mickey complained in 2010, 2011 that he was suffering from elder abuse. And there's a question about, is that real or is that false? Depending upon which stepchild, which stepson you speak to, it's real or false. His one stepson, Chris, said it's absolutely untrue that Mickey was never abused. In fact, Mickey was the one doing the abusing. If you speak to the other stepson, Mickey was being abused. The police were being called to the home in Thousand Oaks because Mickey had bruises on him, but there were never any charges leveled. There was never any arrests.
Bill Burns, we're going to take a break here. I'm sorry to interrupt. We're going to take a break here. When we come back, we'll pick up the story about the abuse. We'll be opening up the phone lines with your questions or comments about either of Bill Burns' books that we've discussed tonight. Much more to come here on Coast to Coast AM. The Pretenders take us into the break. Poignant tune there from Blind Faith, an early super group, Can't Find My Way Home. And we've got another poignant tale we've been talking about in this hour, the life and times of Mickey Rooney with Bill Burns. But as noted, Bill is here tonight to talk about two books that he's written, two new books that are out. The earlier one, UFO Hunters Book 2, which was the subject of the earlier part of the program this evening, and we're going to be opening up the phone lines with your questions for Bill about either of those or comments, whatever. We have one more segment remaining in Coast to Coast. Stick around. Bill, I want to give you a chance to finish up in discussing Mickey's last years there, because as you were noting before the break, at least according to one close member of the family, there was no abuse, there was no stealing of his money. But I seem to recall that even at his memorial service or funeral, there was bickering about who would control the body. There were allegations about missing millions. So there must be some kind of allegations in there that are worth exploring.
Well, there were. I mean, on the one hand, the biological children didn't even know their father had died until they heard it on TMZ. There was a fight over who was going to be in charge of the funeral, because there was no money left for the funeral. So a Hollywood publicity agent named Roger Neal, he got this one Hollywood cemetery to provide a mausoleum for Mickey at no charge. So, I mean, there was that. You had the attorneys for the conservatorship. Mickey claimed that he was being abused. That was his claim. And he testified before the Senate Committee on Aging about elder abuse. He never said he was being physically abused. He said money was being stolen from his accounts, that he was being psychologically abused. But it was only his allegation. So he went to court and he asked the court to provide him with a conservatorship. In other words, he becomes a ward of the court, and the court appoints an attorney to handle his affairs. That's what happened. They appointed an attorney, and the attorney designated his other stepson, Mark Aber, to be his custodian, his caretaker. And Mickey went to live with Mark. And the attorney said to Mickey's wife, Jan — we interviewed the attorney extensively — he said to Jan, look, here's the way this can go. You now have a choice. You can live with Mark and Mickey, your husband, or you can stay with your other stepson and be separated from Mickey. Your choice, which way do you want to go? So she chose to stay with her stepson, Chris, and they separated, but they never divorced. So Mickey spent his final 2 years living with his stepson and his stepson's wife, in their home in the Valley. And so basically, but what happened was, when we saw the billing records, the amount of money that was spent on — basically they sold Mickey's house in Thousand Oaks — there was a lot of money that was spent in legal bills. There were huge legal bills, and so easily over $1 million was eaten up in legal fees. Probably perfectly legitimate, but it was a lot of money for a conservatorship. And so as it stands now, how it was divided was that you have the biological children saying that they should get some inheritance from Mickey, because Mickey told his children he would take care of them for the rest of their lives. You have his wife, Jan, who was entitled to proceeds from Mickey as his spouse, right? California is a community property state. So anything Mickey earned during the marriage, half of that goes to the community, and that's Jan. And then you have the children that he lived with at the end of his life. So there is money there. Nobody knows where it is and how to get it. But here's the weird thing. So Mickey wrote 3 or so wills toward the end of his life, from 2010 all the way to 2014. The children, the biological children, were really concerned that Mickey's signature on his final will looked very different from his signatures on previous documents. So a friend of mine who's a reporter at the National Enquirer said, you know what, send me the wills, and I'm going to have a handwriting expert see if it's really Mickey's signature. Okay, great. So I did that, and I like handwriting experts, because that's how we solved the case of the murder of the Black Dahlia, with a handwriting expert. So the handwriting expert says that was Mickey's signature, but Mickey did not know what he was signing when he signed the final will 3 weeks before he died of congestive heart failure. So now the whole thing is back in court, and we will see what happens.
Wow. We've got the phone lines are pretty much full here with questions and comments about Mickey Rooney, so we're going to get to as many as we can. We have on the wild card line in Los Angeles is Miranda, who says she's the daughter of Carmen Miranda and Cesar Romero and knew Mickey's kids. Hi, Miranda. You're on with Bill Burns.
Thank you. Fantastic show. It really hits my heart. I'm so surprised to hear about it because I grew up with his children, Tim Rooney and the other one, and Dan Kessel, and they did a TV show with me at KPAL Television in the high desert, Channel 56. And I was amazed because they were the sweetest, kindest people, so talented, so gifted, and they had Corey Feldman, who was on there also, and it was just like an amazing experience. And his mother, BJ, one of the nicest human beings I've ever met, and in a really dark time in my life, when I was really having a rough time with my own personal life, they were the only people there for me. And I was amazed at what God-loving people they are, and I'm still very close with the one who, I know Tim Rooney died, and he was just the nicest person. And his brother, the other one, Mickey Rooney, still alive, but just the most beautiful people I've ever met, and just pure-hearted, and really honest, really upfront, and you would never believe what kind human beings, very genuine. And I'm still close with one who's a stepbrother, and he's helped
Dan Kessel?
Yeah, Dan, he's awesome.
Dan Kessel is wonderful. Dan Kessel is really fabulous. We interviewed Dan Kessel a lot. Dan was the person who told us this great story of the band, the Rooney Brothers, who were up and down Sunset Strip back in the 60s, back in the late 60s.
Son, the famous guitar player who trained the Beatles. I mean, these are amazing people. And
right.
Dan Kessel got me through my own journey, which I have a book and a film coming out as the secret love child of Cesar Romero and Carmen Miranda. And previously,
hey, Miranda, you're going to have to send me an email. We'll take a look at your book.
All right. Give me. You know what? I would love to if you could.
All right. Well, the lady who's the handling the calls, G. Lee, will get your information and you can send us a note. We'll check it out. Thanks for calling. Appreciate it. We're going to go to Joe in the Bronx on the wild card line. Has a question about Mickey Rooney and Judy Garland. Hi, Joe. Joe in the Bronx, are you there? One more time. We'll try Joe in the Bronx on the wild card two line. Hey, Joe, how you doing?
Okay. I'd like to ask your guest, Bill Burns, was there anything between Mickey Rooney and Judy Garland? And if so, can you elaborate on that?
Good question.
The answer is yes. Mickey said that Judy was the sister he never had. That was Mickey's statement. But when you talk to one of the mysteries of Mickey Rooney was that he had a mistress who shall go unnamed for 60 years. We call her Mrs. Smith in the book. And she would tell the story that when Mickey and Judy would get together kind of later in life, their children would all be at Judy Garland's house in Malibu, and Mickey and Judy would go upstairs to the bedroom, and they'd come down all disheveled. So they were, call them, quote-unquote, sex buddies. Friends, but they didn't mince any words about having sex together.
But as you note in the book, Bill, I mean, the bond between them was beyond that. It was something pretty special.
Oh, God. Yeah. I mean, when Judy died, Mickey said that he threw himself on the ground and was pounding the earth and said, Judy, Judy, why did you do this? And then years later, he said, you had the right idea. I should have done it myself.
We have Michael in Long Island on the wild card line number three, who has a question about the drugs that were given. Is he gone? He's gone. All right, we're going to try Dave in Chicago. Hi, Dave. You're on with Bill Burns.
George, hello, Bill.
Hi.
Well, you got L.A., New York, Chicago. You hit the trifecta there.
There you go.
So you know everybody's listening to you, George and Bill, tonight. I wanted to just say I saw Mickey Rooney live in, I believe it was 1980, 1981, Sugar Babies tour.
yeah.
in Chicago at the Erie Crown Theater. Was that the years that that was going on? Like,
yeah, Mickey was Mickey toured with the show. Yes,
Ann Miller, wasn't it? Ann Miller,
fabulous.
And I'm a musician by trade, so I kind of observe things maybe a little differently than everybody, and I noticed that he was very in charge of every aspect of the production. Like, he was, you could tell, you know, he was like a master of entertainment and production, and, you know, the whole thing. He just like kind of steered the whole event, and it was fabulous and very captivating. I was just wondering, was he like doing drugs then? Because he seemed pretty wired.
Oh, he was doing drugs his entire life. I mean, he was on lithium for his entire life for bipolar disorder. Lithium kind of mellows out your mood. But one of the things that Mickey was also on was incredible amounts of painkillers.
Was he on amphetamines or something? I think Dave is suggesting he seemed kind of wired.
Well, he was wired. He was on he wasn't on methamphetamines per se, but he was on uppers. Not meth, but he was on uppers that were prescription drugs. Yes.
Thanks, Dave. Appreciate the call. We got a first-time caller, Thomas in Arkansas, going back to talk about UFO-related topics. In regard to the first book we discussed tonight, UFO Hunters Book 2. Hi, Thomas. You're on with Bill Burns.
Hey, good morning, George. Good morning, Bill. How are y'all this morning?
Hi.
I'm doing good.
I had a quick comment about the military. Once I joined the military, I didn't really know what to expect. And I can remember one class in particular when we were trained specifically on how to deal with UFO sightings and then UFO landings, and how to deal specifically with extraterrestrials and UFO landing. Later on, I became a police officer, and I'm still a police officer currently, and I have been called to one particular UFO sighting, which was probably one of the stranger things that I have had to deal with, which was basically like a huge ball of shaped mercury in the sky. But you had talked about the units that come out with the military, and I just wanted to comment to that to say that it's there, and everyone down to the smallest private is trained on how to deal specifically with UFO landings, extraterrestrial issues. All those things are true. There's no doubt. They teach classes on it when you enter the military.
Wow, and Thomas, elaborate. I mean, who's running the show on that?
Okay, when you enter the military, whether that be the Army, the Marines, etc., you have classes. One class will teach you how to perform certain duties with your rifle, whether it be shoot it, clean it, whatever. You have a class on land navigation where you use compasses and maps. Then you have a particular class on how to deal with UFO and extraterrestrial issues. The basics, it's pretty simple. You go through a pre-stepped process where when and if something lands, you are called out to it, or if you happen to be standing guard in a certain area, your first thing is to cordon. So you put on a cordon, and that's what the military basically calls, like you'd wrap a police line around it. No one in, no one out. Extraterrestrials don't come out. Humans don't go in. No one in or out, period. If you have to use deadly force, then that's what you have to use, because no one comes in or out, period. Then your second step is to call to hire to make sure that, you know, your hire is coming. Whoever is in charge of that particular place or that particular unit, they come out. And then if extraterrestrial contact is made, then if they come out of a ship or something like that, and then you'd have to call up to hire. But the only contact that you are allowed to make, unless you are a higher rank, is to tell the extraterrestrial, hopefully in some way they can understand you, you tell them that you have called to hire and your superior will be there shortly to talk about anything. but they do not leave and no one else enters. So first thing is the cordon, then you call the hire, give them a report of what's going on, and then if contact is made with the extraterrestrial, then, you know, like I say, you tell them in whatever way you can that hire is on the way and your leadership will be there.
So, Thomas, let me ask you, are you told not to talk about this?
Absolutely. If you are in higher command, that will be dictated as needed at the time. We'll just take, for instance, the Roswell situation. Or you could do Kecksburg or any of the others. Thing lands, and I mean, it's pretty textbook the way the military deals with it. There's a cordon set up, just like the class says, no one in or out. That's pretty textbook. That's what you hear in all the reports from civilians that may be in the area. The military won't let you in, and nobody's coming out, definitely. And then once they call the hire comes, and all of those, whoever the superior command is at the time, and they could come from different military factions. It just depends. It could be civilian.
I'll tell you what, Thomas, we don't have enough time to go into a lot of detail. Why don't you send me an email, because I'd like to also hear the story about this ball of mercury in the sky. Give an email address to G. Lee, our call screener, and we'll be in touch. I'll pass it along to Bill. I think he might have some questions for you as well. Thanks for calling. Try to get one more quick call in east of the Rockies, Barry in South Carolina. Hi, Barry. You're on with Bill Burns.
Hello there, George. I was just about to drift off to sleep when the show came on, and the next thing I knew, you were slamming into my radio like a nanoparticle of unobtainium.
We got a minute left. Barry,
right,
thanks.
Real
thanks.
Quick. Oh, I'm so disappointed and so sad to hear Mickey Rooney is one of my all-time favorite comedians and actors. And I had heard a few rumors, but I didn't know it was quite as bad as it was. And so anyway, I'll just comment on that and tell you and Phil, great, great show tonight, George. And please keep up the good work.
Thank you, Barry, for that call. And I think, Bill, what Barry touched on is how I reacted to it, too. It's the story you tell in this book, The Life and Times of Mickey Rooney. It's sad. I mean, it's sad on so many levels.
I mean, people shouldn't have to be that forlorn, that desperate, that destitute at the end of their lives, not especially when they've done so much. But that's what happened, and he was his own worst enemy, but he was the textbook case of somebody who was never raised by parents.
Bill, I want to thank you for coming on to talk about it. I recommend both of these books. They're great reads. UFO Hunters Book 2 and The Life and Times of Mickey Rooney. Always a pleasure to speak with you. I don't know. I'd hate to have your coffee, Bill, because you can't possibly sleep much as you crank out.
I do work 24/7. Thank you very much. It was my pleasure, George. Have a wonderful rest of the
evening. Hope you'll come back when that next book comes out. Thanks again. All right. Thanks also to my earlier guest, John Greenwald of the Black Vault, and to my colleagues there at Coast to Coast, Jeff DeRay, Juan Velasquez, Nathan Staten, G. Lee, Dan Galani, our webmaster, Lex Lonehood, Chris Boros, and I'll be back next month, everyone. Good night.